episode 4 of the Ad Brief, and this is our first episode with a new surprise guest. This episode is me, Noah Rosenberg from Happy Medium, and Osk Wappling from Adland. How'd I do on your name?
You did really well. Thank you.
Okay, and then we've also got Evan Brown. Evan, you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi, I'm a ACD at Saatchi in LA.
And on Twitter?
Twitter, I would be Strawberry Cough.
What is a strawberry cough?
Well, it was a mistake in a username, I guess I should say, because it was a reference from Children of Men, the movie, in which Michael Caine talks about smoking pot and coughing and how it smells like or tastes like strawberries. And I don't really smoke pot, but I get a lot of people wanting to follow me that are pot heavy. So
your hookah is just tobacco.
Exactly.
So do you guys want to get started and talk about some stuff that happened during the week?
Sure.
Yeah.
We had a little bit of recap news. Last episode, we talked about Kmart and why anybody would want to go there. And then all of a sudden, it's been all over the ad world with this new ad. What did you guys think of it, first of all? The ship your pants.
Oh, the ship your pants.
Yeah. Did you see that one?
Yeah. No, I didn't see that one yet.
So it was on the Today Show. Even.
Yeah, and it was all over Reddit.
Yeah,
as well.
And basically, you know, I was surprised because a lot of people's reactions seemed to be, I hate Kmart, but since they almost swore in a commercial, I like them now.
It reminds me of the Make 7 Up Yours commercials from, when was that, the late 90s, early 2000s? It's the same sort of the almost swear that we've seen a couple of times before, except the difference is this one was populated on Reddit, which is why it has 10 million hits. But I mean, we in Adland, they had a story about a previous Kmart spot in which they flew a shark from the East Coast to the West Coast to film the spot in warmer weather, and the shark died. And then they ended up going with a squirrel in that spot instead, and that caused a lot of heat from animal rights activists and people that are, what would you call them, common sense. They so that initially is the spot that we were talking about before you mentioned the ship my pants one, and I guess the ship my pants one is a nice way to make us forget about the fact that the Kmart people killed a shark on their set.
Yeah.
For a spot that really didn't require a shark. So I guess as a palate cleanser, it works.
Yeah, I'm just curious about one thing. It's roughly 2 weeks ago that it appeared on Reddit, and a day later, it was gone from Reddit. And when I went searching for it, it was embedded in, I don't know, 27 different sites, that same YouTube video that later disappeared. And I'm just curious to why you would put up a video and then remove it a day later. And then now it's like apparently embedded everywhere else. So I'm like, why is it back up?
Yeah, was it meant to just be a web viral, you're saying?
Yeah, I think so. I couldn't find it forever, and nobody at Kmart gave it to Adland, so I never wrote a story about it because, you know, there's only enough that much time in the day begging for ads I want to write about.
Yeah, maybe it, you know, because it got picked up on Today's Show or went viral, however it did. Because I've never seen it on its own. I've just seen it embedded in the Today Show clip. And I think a lot of people are sort of like, hey, that's great. They almost swore. But, you know, they do that on Saturday Night Live, and it's like the worst. Like, you guys remember the cork soaker? You know, they had Janet Jackson, I think it was, soaking her cork. You know, it's a common old joke. The thing that's odd to me about it is, it's such a non-message for Kmart. It's odd to me that makes everybody love Kmart. But I guess they're thinking it's just an affinity play. Like if we make a joke as sort of like a present to you with a wink and a nod saying, we know we can't pull this off usually in TV commercials, but here we did it somehow. Yeah. That makes us like the brand or makes us want to shop at Kmart. I mean, if the whole idea is shipping my pants, I'm pretty sure anybody knows how to do that without going through Kmart.
Well, I think the larger issue is this notion that somehow, getting a very quick exposure on the Today Show or, you know, a certain number of one-time views and shares on social media is going to equate with my deciding to go to Kmart to buy anything, let alone pants. And, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, social media's role isn't for that. It's to get a little blast out, to get people talking about the brand. But I don't know that that really is ever going to do much beyond getting people to talk about the brand. And at some point, you have to ask yourself, is all this talking actually translating into sales? Are people going to venture into the near third world that is Kmart right. and buy something? Because we were just in a Kmart maybe a month ago buying a bicycle helmet. And this is in LA. This is not, you know, this is kind of a metropolis. It looked like it hadn't been updated since Reagan was president. So, you know, is one video where they make a joke on swearing going to really affect our opinion of it?
And really, I mean, based on the appearance of the Kmart, like, what there, we all expect there to be swearing at Kmart. That's not a revelation, right? We'd be surprised if people had proper diction when they were shopping at Kmart.
Yeah, there's certainly no Target people, I'll say that much.
Right.
That kind of actually brings us to social media, because you were talking about like this ad being spread on social media, and that's how advertising seems to be today. And I was just thinking about what happened today and how people were reacting in social media. Were you all on Twitter when the Boston Marathon happened?
Yeah, I was. It's hard to sort of respond to it now, but it was pretty interesting to see how, you know, as soon as anything happens like that now, the first thing I do is go to Twitter. I didn't check CNN. I checked it about after about 10 minutes, and they had an, you know, some celebrity crap as the headliner on CNN. So Twitter was definitely the most credible source for news. And I don't know if the right term is interesting, but there were people retweeting racers, you know, the tweets of racers, people who were down there on the scene, and they had a video of it not even 10 minutes after it happened.
Yeah.
I think the best tweet or retweet that I saw today was from a friend of mine. He retweeted it, and it said, "Twitter is great in these types of situations for the first 5 minutes, and then is absolute shit for the next 12 hours."
Yeah.
And you see the trajectory that, you know, the first 5 minutes are proper dissemination of information, and then it devolves into the Me Too crowd who are sending out their thoughts and prayers, the people on their soapboxes that are blaming X fringe group for the incident. And then you have the people that are constantly telling you, this is not the time to be auto-tweeting. This is not the time to be living your life. And I was talking about this with Osk earlier, and it's kind of funny. I know that it's social media and it's public, but, you know, taking that attitude is, what if you were at home and you're watching CNN, as you said, and they're talking about Jay-Z in Cuba, and I were to knock on your door, and when you opened the door, I smacked you and said, this is no time to be watching Jay-Z.
Right.
I mean, it's a bit asinine in the sense that you can impose some sort of universal etiquette on a channel that's anything but controllable.
Yeah, and I think to that point too, they're saying, okay, everybody, collectively wake up in the same unconscious way. Like, everybody pay attention by not really paying attention and just do all the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. No, I had this discussion with Tim Nudd from Adweek when Sandy Hook happened, because, you know, he's a dad and I'm a mom, and we chat on Twitter. And so we saw everybody going out with their thoughts and prayers while we were both fighting our urge to run to our children's elementary schools. And we were wondering why advertising agencies and other such non-brands were sending out their thoughts and prayers, because it was really like, why are you doing that? It's not information, and it seems very Me Too, you know, if brands.
Is there any other response? Are they just saying, we're also watching the news? Because, I mean, to hear it, your thoughts and your prayers go out automatically.
Well, to put it, yeah, exactly. That's basically what they're saying. But like, put it this way, I'm very much a news addict, and I'm pretty much always on Twitter. So when scary stuff has happened, like there was earthquakes in Tokyo and stuff, Adland has tweeted out information of what's been going on. So like earthquake in Tokyo, Adland tweeted out that the people in Dentsu with the famous elevators were all okay as soon as I found out that they were all okay. And this was retweeted by Dentsu people over in London who were actually concerned about their coworkers. So that's information, right? And today when I found out that StudioCom in Boston, which is a block away from where this happened, that they were all accounted for, I tweeted that out because it's information. But I'm not going to tweet out Adland's thoughts and prayers are there. They are there, trust me. It's just that's not helping anybody.
Well, it's like, are we going to get magnetic ribbons on the back of our car tomorrow and everybody's going to tweet a picture saying they support the Boston Marathon? I mean, of course we all support it. I don't feel like it's some amazing stretch to offer that in the same way that it feels like they're sort of portraying it like it is. And I'm not saying it's a bad sentiment at all, or that we should try and be creative in this kind of thing, but it just doesn't feel very honest or in the moment. That's
exactly it.
I just think it's weird, to be honest. I mean, I get on one level, it's the damned if you do, damned if you don't, because if they don't say anything, then people could say, well, how dare Oreos not take a stand on this or whatever. But it goes back to... what was it the other week when it was the marriage equality and that one site went up that was presupposing that all brands are for marriage equality, and then waiting to see if any brand would come by and tell them to change their stance. And I guess my argument is that, you know, when it comes to lobbyists or when it comes to organizations that are policy influencers, very obvious ones like the NRA or Philip Morris or whatever, then I can kind of understand you're wanting to know where they take a stance on certain issues. But when it comes to Oreos, I don't really care where they stand on gay marriage, because Oreos is a brand. Oreos is, they're cookies, right? So I find it really hard to accept it as being a genuine statement in the same way that all of the brands saying their hearts and their prayers go out to fill in the city or incident, because it just feels very shallow to me, you know? It may be very well that these people really, really believe what they're saying. But when you're speaking for a brand and it says Kellogg's go hearts and minds go out to Boston, you know, it's not the same thing as if the CMO or the CCO or the CFO of Kellogg's makes a statement with their name.
Right. It's just the intern that's piloting the Twitter account.
Yeah, exactly. No, that makes total sense. And it's also like when New York was underwater, basically, and after the storm this fall, Budweiser did cans of water, which they transported to New York, and Duracell was there with batteries so people could recharge their cell phones, which they totally needed to do. These were brands getting involved and helping. And, you know, that's a lot better than tweeting out their thoughts and prayers.
Well, I guess it's because, you know, talk is cheap at the end of the day. And it's the same thing as the conspicuous philanthropy of the Red campaign. And, you know, if I spend an extra $25 on a sweatshirt, then I can feel good about myself and everyone will know that I've done it. But, you know, having said that, because we're dealing with an incident that is not even a day old, we don't know what those brands are going to do tomorrow. You know, they may very well do something. They may very well try to raise money or get people out to donate blood or whatever. But I also think in the ensuing chaos that occurs when these types of incidents happen, we start to look at the first responders with an ever bigger microscope. And I also think that's a detriment too, because, you know, I'm not expecting Red Cross to act within 3 seconds of my retweet. And if that expectation is upon them, then there are a lot of naive people on Twitter, right? Because that's not how the world works. You actually need time to formulate a plan and then enact it. It's not like they're standing by ready with packets of plasma and can get into that scene when there's all these barricades. So I think there's a bit of there has to be a bit of give and take, a bit of forgiveness on brands and And also, we shouldn't be putting such high expectations on them too, when after all, they're, you know, it's a corporate business.
Right. And the funniest thing was the bad timing of Adweek, because they've tweeted out that the Boston Marathon, with the hashtag right. Boston Marathon tragedy, shows why brands need a human touch on Twitter, which was their response to basically everybody in the world, including Ford's CMO, tweeting out that one should not have a brand Twitter account on auto Twitter today of all days. So their tweet about not being insensitive when news happens was really insensitive by accident.
Well, it's just, you know, I think the thing that I really value about Twitter is that I have access to a million different voices or different opinions about things from all over around the world. But then in moments like this, if it gets clogged with everybody saying basically the same thing with of non-information, it's just adding noise to the signal. So, you know, having all brands immediately rush to Twitter and tweet in a way just kind of clogs it up. You almost wish there was some way to shut down anything but actual news or something that's going to contribute to the story.
Yeah, or actual information. I mean, I find there would be a difference if like, say, Kraft or Velveeta, you know, tweets out that our factory is unharmed and everybody's accounted for. That would be like a different thing than if Velveeta tweets out our thoughts and prayers.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess the only flip side I can think of is, you know, on divisive issues, if I hear that a company's lined up in a way that I don't support, like, you know, Chick-fil-A against gay marriage, I stop going there.
But again, though, I mean, Chick-fil-A is a special case in the sense that that was a top-down initiative, shall we say, which, of course, had nothing to do with sales. In the negative, if anything, everybody's protest just gave Chick-fil-A more credit and more exposure. And you might say conversely or perversely, depending on where you stand on the issue, their sales went up at that point. But at the same time, there was during Aurora, there was somebody in the UK who that was for a clothing design store. I don't remember which, but Adlan had it up, where somebody had tweeted that, oh, it looks like Aurora is trending because of our Aurora dresses or whatever. And you could say to that person, well, you know, that person should be held responsible for their tweets because they should obviously be looking at what's going on globally on Twitter. But at the same time, they were in the UK, right? So to blame one person for the tweet, unless it's the CMO or somebody important, as you alluded to before, it's probably an intern who's running the account. I don't know that it's necessarily fair to judge an entire brand based on one tweet. I mean, it's not like it's Jay Carney speaking for the president. You know what I'm saying? It could be anybody. It could be somebody's daughter who's just being a goof or whatever. So as much as I love social media, I also take a lot of it with a grain of salt, especially on dates like today, because of the divisiveness of the issue. My Twitter feed looked more like the old Morton Downey Jr. show where people were just yelling at each other, or Jerry Springer. You know, it didn't look like this civil discourse at all.
What was the opposite stance? What were people arguing over?
Well, I mean, one level, people were taking the media, in my opinion, correctly to task for jumping to conclusions about who was responsible for this incident. Some people were jumping down Wolf Blitzer's throat because he said, oh, maybe it has something to do with Patriots Day or whatever he said. I don't remember. And, you know, some people were equating with certain fringe groups. You know, perhaps this was the anti-gun people, or perhaps it was this and that. And, you know, the role of the media shouldn't really be to speculate. It should be to report the news as they get it. But in this instance, to always be first and always be retweeted the most and always be upvoted, I think that people are more than happy in a social media world to sort of offer up their opinion. And I mean, I guess that's what we've been talking about the whole time. I mean, it's brands are doing it the same way when they're sending condolences and or suggesting that we shouldn't auto-tweet. I mean, everybody has a POV. Everybody has an opinion, you know. And sadly, sometimes that also happens in journalism, which was at least in theory supposed to be objective.
And I think along with that line, you're saying everybody has a POV with a brand active in a social media space. They have one POV, which is to promote the brand, right? So it's a strategic move to be involved in social media, and they have a social media policy and a social media plan. The brand isn't there to use Twitter in the same way you or I would, right? It's a different small megaphone. And when they are tweeting, whatever it is they're tweeting, whatever action they're taking, it's to in some way raise the brand, in some way, you know, promote back to the brand, right? Otherwise, they wouldn't say anything. So in this case, I think part of the reason why it feels so cheap is because it feels like the brand is doing it in a self-serving way. I mean, a brand isn't a person, as much as we like to pretend it. A brand is a corporate entity that only can serve, you know, its interests, unless it's something like, you know, the Red Cross, which I don't think is using Twitter for branding purposes. It's using it for information purposes.
Yeah, but do you remember the kerfuffle that happened when somebody mixed up, the social media person for the Red Cross mixed up their personal account with the Red Cross account and made some joke about being drunk? And I think that Red Cross handled that beautifully and with kind of grace and sort of self-deprecating humor that I love. But again, I also think that if you're a brand and you're on social media, and let's say you're Oreo or you're Axe or Taco Bell or one of those brands that have a lot of followers, it's almost like if you say something, then people are going to call you out for being self-serving. If you don't say something, then people are going to call you out for being callous. It does become a really tricky gray area when you're a high-profile brand and you're in this situation, you know?
Should we start a Tumblr of brands that didn't pledge their thoughts and prayers?
Yes. And we, you know what? We assume that they don't care unless they email us and tell us otherwise.
Right.
And then we'll know, right?
Right.
I feel that when it comes to situations like these, you're right, Evan. The brands are damned if they do and damned if they don't. But smaller brands, such as advertising agencies, which are brands, but they are companies. I mean, like Digitas. Digitas confirmed very late, very like basically just now, that they had 5 staffers that were running the marathon and that they were all okay. And this is like an important piece for Digitas to say, you know, because there are people who know that these people at Digitas were running the race,
right?
And they will be looking at Digitas Twitter feed to find out something, or, you know, because I mean, the first thing you do if you know somebody that is involved there is not to go to Twitter going, I know somebody who's involved. You're going to go to your phone and you're going to text your friend.
Yeah. But the problem with that, Osk, is that they actually shut down cell phone service in Boston because they were of the notion that the cell phone might detonate one of the explosives. So we don't know that Digitas didn't try reaching out to these people and had a white knuckle day. You know,
oh, I'm sure they did. What I'm saying is that Digitas shared for us who didn't reach these people that they found them and that they're okay. And this is like the type of message I think is very appropriate because it's sharing info that people are okay.
Exactly. Right. And but see, also they're directly involved.
Yeah. And it's like it's not the kind of tweet where it goes, we reached out to our friends and they're OK, not naming friends and not naming anything else, which I've seen several brands do. And I find that to be a look at me tweet. And that's really disturbing when you see brands do that, or not brands. But like, for instance, there was an award show that did that tonight. And I think that was incredibly tasteless.
Right. And I think that's the point, is anything that you think could end up in the metric could be anything that you would imagine seeing in a case study. Just don't do it. Anything that you would imagine you're going to pat yourself on the back for your, you know, terrific, clever reaction to a tragedy. Just don't.
I would even venture one step farther and say anything that you wouldn't do in person, don't do it.
Just in general, right?
Yeah.
On Twitter in general.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I wouldn't go up to all of my friends at Saatchi today and say, you know what? I reached out to all of my Boston friends and they're okay.
Yeah.
It just seems a bit, it seems, I mean, I know that people love the whole you're a personal brand thing, and I'm loathe with that, that phrase, but I also think that, you know, your behavior really shouldn't in an absolute world be that different online than it would be in real life?
Right.
You know, you wouldn't be a troll in real life. You shouldn't be a troll online. So you shouldn't be a self-serving, kind of smarmy shithead online if you wouldn't do that in real life either.
Or if you do it online, you're saying that you really are a smarmy.
Exactly. That is just so disturbing. I was just picturing somebody walking around in the office going, I've reached out to all my Boston friends and they're okay. Just telling everybody that at the office. Like, how disturbing is that person?
Right. Well, they're trying to claim some tragedy for themselves.
Yeah.
So
let's skip to something less depressing because this is very,
yeah, I don't
very
know
sad.
Any good transition. This slightly less depressing. You were talking.
You guys. Sorry, I was going to say you guys probably need a segue bumper music.
What would be a good bumper music from that?
Well, I guess it would be the equivalent of like a "Let's all go to the lobby," yeah. But you know, with a play on segue. I'm spitballing here. You know, it's late even on the late time. So,
slightly less depressing, maybe. Oscar, you were talking about award shows earlier, and there's some coming up. Evan, do you have anything that you're going to submit this year?
Just kind of started this job the end of the month, or the end of November, rather. I'm not sure if any of last year's work from my previous agency of record is going to be submitted. This time around, I'm not really sure. I'm going to go with no, unless I'm surprised and delighted to learn that I've won something.
Yeah. No, I was thinking because of award shows, there's a few things that always happens on Adland. First of all, we get a ridiculous amount of case studies. And so like today we get a case study on a poster in Auckland and it's a billboard. There's a case study about a billboard. It's really kind of pathetic. All you need is a photograph for that. And the second thing is that every single award will tell us about their juries and their tweet ups and wherever on earth they are. But what I find is more fun is looking at what won last year in most of these award shows. And that's when I decided that we have to have Evan on because Evan wrote for several commercials that won awards last year, but it was also because of what type of commercials it is. And this is something that I think a lot of students are wondering about, because how on earth do you write TV scripts and radio spots that famous people are going to be saying so that it sounds like it's actually the famous person's real words? So, for example, last year you did the Pacific Standard Time. And
with Ice Cube. And I should take a step back and say that was a campaign I was really fortunate to be assigned, because there were two spots that had already been finished, pretty much in the can, that involved Jason Schwartzman and Anthony Kiedis from the Chili Peppers. And when it came my turn, I had to do something with Ice Cube, and even kind of more puzzling at first was Charles and Ray Eames. And thankfully, I didn't have to write for them, you know, because they're deceased, but Ice Cube was already weighty enough as it was. And it was an interesting process, but having worked with celebrities before, it's in some ways it's really no different than any other writing I'm going to do, right? And I guess what I mean by that is, first of all, I think a lot of copywriters, especially if they're new to the industry, need to understand that this is War and Peace in some ways. This is on the road or whatever. And what I mean by that isn't equating what I do with literature, but any novel that's worth its salt had a lot of editors behind it, right? It was never really a first draft that saw the light of day. And it's the same thing with writing. It doesn't matter if it's with a celebrity or not, right? The added fun is when you have a specific voice in the form of celebrity, because you're always writing with a voice, right? But in this case, it was a guy who is known for Friday and is known for some of the best hip hop ever created, but is also known for Are We There Yet? And he actually has a spectrum And then you have to decide, first of all, okay, is this going to be the serious Ice Cube, or is it going to be the kind of funny Ice Cube? And, you know, how does he relate to the material? And I think what a lot of people didn't know, probably because our case study didn't get that deep with it, is that Ice Cube studied architectural drafting. So he actually had a connection. It wasn't like we were just plucking some random person and throwing him in there. He actually had some knowledge on the subject. But I wrote the script and framed it the way I kind of wanted it to be, knowing full well that once he got his hands on it, he was going to add his spin. And you know what? I'm perfectly happy with that because I'm not him. And there's no way that I could write it the way that he would speak it anymore, that I could write it for Jerry Lewis or Christopher Plummer or, you know, Katy Perry or any of those people. I'm not those people. The best that anybody can do is write, you know, a great piece that would live on its own and hope that they're going to add some magic to it and make it better. And I was lucky enough to make that reality.
Did you get the sense that if you had showed up with Katy Perry's script, he would have just read it straight through, or did it seem like he was gonna have his take on it?
Not at all. This was collaboration with a capital C, which is amazing, because oftentimes you hear that word collaboration and it usually has a different definition, and it's usually a definition along the lines of I'm going to change everything and you're gonna nod your head.
Agency collaboration.
Exactly. But in this case, it was Jayanta Jenkins, who was my boss at Shiat at the time, who was cool enough to allow me to run with my concept and get enthusiastic about it. And then we sent it over to our director, Dave Myers, who's really awesome, who actually directed Cube and a couple of things, as well as Katy Perry. He actually won the VMAs for her Firework video. And with Cube himself. And so I would send it over to the director and he would pass along the Cube, and Cube would be like, okay, I like where this is going. Maybe we can change this part. Maybe we can. He never said, this is what I want to say. He never said, I don't want to use this word. He was more participatory in the storyline. And then when we got the script and we got to a place where we were happy with it, then when we got on set and he warmed up is when he started adding some stuff here and there. And, you know, we would have some filler that became some really important parts. Like there's a point where he's driving in his Lincoln Continental and the DP is literally hanging with his ass out of the car to get this really cool shot of him in profile. And we're in the video village, the mobile village behind him. And, you know, the director saying like, well, talk about the traffic in LA, you know, and that part wasn't scripted. I mean, I mentioned it here and there and I mentioned what I thought about the traffic. But, you know, when he says, oh, you know, you're driving on the 110, that's gangsta traffic. Like I never would have written that line. I wouldn't have felt, frankly, comfortable writing that line.
Yeah, it's up to him when to say gangster, right? Yeah. He coined the phrase almost.
Exactly. And I felt like if I had gone in there and written it the way I thought he would have said, I would have A, felt like an asshole, and B, probably been kicked off the set.
So you said he has a spectrum. Which character did he bring to you know, pre-planning meetings? Did he introduce himself as, you know, O'Shea Jackson, or does he say, you can call me Cube, or, you know?
There were really no pre-planning meetings that most of us were privy to. I mean, he showed up on set. He had a well-thumbed, well-read, well-dog-eared copy of Charles and Ray Eames' work. So he had immersed himself in not only their culture, but their story as well. And I think, like, in talks with the director, he said, you know, he's been known for doing Are We There Yet? He's been known for doing these kind of, was it Coors Light, I think, commercials where he was playing his more comedic side. And he really wanted to do the Cube who had some knowledge, the Cube who has a philosophy about his hometown. And, you know, this guy loves LA. He loves LA. And there's nobody out there who's going to tell him otherwise. So in some ways, I really want to believe that he pretty much brought himself to the table. Now, he put on a little bit of swagger, but even if you strip away the swagger, it's a conversation that was based on the script, and I would say probably 85% of it was lifted from that.
That's what I find so interesting because I'm thinking about the ad student type listeners here. They would always sit and draw up a campaign where they pick the celebrity to go with the thing. So finding out that he used to be an architectural draft, is that what it was called, student? That's what he studied? That's.
Draft.
Yeah, that there was like an era where there were a sort of technical college commercials, and that was one of the big things you could study. You know, it was.
Yeah, but I had no idea that he had done
Yeah.
that. That's pretty cool. So that makes him fit in a way that's very surprising and unexpected to me. So to me, it's like, oh, you must have picked him because of that. And or you must have picked him because he loves LA so much. And so that makes it a perfect fit. But it's more like when you come to a briefing, it's like, here's the brand and this is the celebrity. We've already paid for it. Now make it work. So that's like going at it, the problem from the other angle. So, and how do you do that? And also, it seems it's very often that when you write, for example, radio commercials or something, that you have to have every word approved before you go into the sound studio to record it. But this seems very wrong and backwards to me too. That's not really how you get an ad out, is it?
No. And having recorded about 2 dozen radio spots for AT&T with Bootsy Collins, I can safely say that what was approved by the client and what became the eventual radio spots in some cases were night and day.
Could
And
Bootsy read a script? I mean, Ice Cube's an actor, right? Bootsy's like
you know
brain
what?
fried.
When I recorded him, when I would we actually this was I don't want to sound crass, but this was the Make-A-Wish dream come true for me because I'm a huge music geek and I love Bootsy. And when we were working with AT&T back in my BBDO days, we had Susan Cradle as our boss, and she was great. She was really pushing the radio to become amazing, you know. And that's probably why she's now heading up Leo's, because she has that drive. You know, you think radio, nobody cares about radio. You think about doing something for a client like AT&T that's kind of out of their comfort zone. You think it would be impossible, but between Susan Cradle and my CD Joe Schrack at the time, they kind of were kind of crazy and believed in me enough to approve this idea that Bootsy Collins would be doling out device advice, as we called it. And I thought he was going to be fried too. I didn't know what to expect. We flew to Cincinnati and we recorded him in his home, which is, we got a tour of his home and we saw all of his platform boots and all of his bass guitars and all of that stuff. He was amazing. I could have just, you know, died on the spot and I would have had a very fulfilling life. But he was in character. He was not William Collins. He was Bootsy for sure. He was wearing the star glasses. He was wearing all red. He was wearing red top hat, red pants, red shirt. The first thing he did, and you know, I'm intimidated. I love P-Funk. I was like, I can't believe I'm even in this guy's house. And the first thing he says is like, he's holding the scripts and he's saying, I want to know who wrote these. Who wrote these? And everybody points to me. And I was with Joe Barone, who he runs Bar One in New York. And anybody would give their right leg to work with this guy. He's going to make your radio better. He's great. But they all pointed to me. And I go over to him and I'm thinking, oh my God, he's going to, I don't know, even know what he's going to do. He reaches out and he gives me this huge bear hug. And he goes, ain't nobody ever gotten into Bootsy's mind like that before. This is going to be a good record, you know. But with him, the only thing that he got thrown on was this word indubitably, which was funny because he used it in one of his songs. But he got stuck in some sort of acid groove, and he spent like 15 minutes trying to say the word, and we finally just moved him on. But I think the lesson for writers there too is sometimes you can hit that voice and get really lucky. But the thing about Joe Barone is he insisted we record everything. He never turned that button off. So even when Bootsy thought he was on break and was talking, we ended up using some of the asides and some of the laughter and some of the inflections and sort of guttural instances in the spot as well, and it really ended in authenticity to it. And I guess that's, at the end of the day, it's like whether it's Ice Cube, whether it's Bootsy, whether it's a regular person, whatever you're writing or art directing too, there has to be that level of authenticity to it, because otherwise it's not going to work.
So you already were familiar with, you know, P-Funk and a big Bootsy fan, or did you have to kind of seep yourself in it, in his way of talking and in his character?
I had been a P-Funk fan since high school. I was already a fan of P-Funk, of Parliament of Funkadelic, of Bootsy Solo. I knew his cadence. I knew the sort of spacey way he has of talking. And I also knew, too, that it had to have been slightly a character as well. I mean, there's no way that you're not like that every day, you know? So it was actually a lot easier to write for him than it was for Cube, because Cube could be, you know, he could be comedy, he could be hardcore, you know? It's like, well, and he's talking about Charles and Ray Eames, the Eames house. Where do you take that, you know? So I think with a lot of celebrities, you tend to write more of a sketch, a fleshed out one, of course, but you write a sketch. And if you're lucky, they'll take that sketch and they'll do something amazing with it. But if they decide not to add anything to it, then your script as scripted better be amazing, because there's always a chance that the client's going to hear that and hear the quote agency version and say, no, we like our own. So you're not off the hook.
Even at the brief level, did you have to pitch scripts to the client in Bootsy's tonality, voice? Did you have to communicate his character back to the client to kind of justify, like, what metric did you use? You know, what was your needle to know if you were pointing in the right direction with the scripts and knowing that you could sell that in, that it would be on point? Because you became kind of the emissary, right, to the brand of Bootsy's voice.
Well, I think from a purely strategic and practical standpoint, they were looking for a long-running campaign that could easily swap out phones, perhaps sales. If you want it to be really interesting, you want it to be engaging, you want people to be entertained, if you are going to go down the road of a sort of template with a spokesman, you can't really just have a regular VO, because people are going to tune that out. So with Susan Cradle and Joe Schrack, we really impressed upon the client that this is going to have to be memorable, and that this memorability is going to help people retain the information, number one, but also drive the sales, right? So when it came time to showcase Bootsy, I mean, yeah, we did have to sit them down. But thankfully about Bootsy is everybody knows who the hell he is. Bootsy's character is established, but we established what role Bootsy was going to be playing with this character who was doling out advice, because it was essentially a call-in show where people from all walks of life were calling in asking what kind of phone they should get, and then hilarity would ensue, right? So in this case, we established that Bootsy was never going to talk down to them, was always going to be helpful, and the comedy was going to come from his world and not necessarily from, you know, him making a pejorative crack at them, right? He was always going to be enthusiastic about them. And as long as we stuck to those parameters, which admittedly are not that limiting with somebody like Bootsy, then we were set. And then we could go wherever we wanted. So if we had a guy who was a software engineer, great. Bootsy would all of a sudden know something about software, right? We had somebody who was trying to join a fraternity and down on her luck, or sorority rather, and down on her luck that she couldn't get in. Well, Bootsy would be consoling them and telling them that they should shine on their own and they don't need a sorority and everything like that. And we could have a lot of fun with it. And again, from my perspective, the part that drove me bananas was the fact that he was actually playing bass on the spot. because we were using the bass as sort of like punctuations of the joke. Yeah, as long as we stuck to the parameters, we could pretty much go to outer space, and I think we did on one of the spots.
Yeah, it's like 10 years later from when people really knew him, or even 20.
They definitely knew Bootsy, and they definitely understood, I mean, for our setup of why we wanted these. And, you know, there were three other directions that they presented that day, and they gravitated towards him because he was a well-known person. They could understand the character, which worked well. And I think it was both Joe Schrock and myself who were taking turns reading the scripts and reading them as Bootsy. And sometimes what we would do is we would act out, you know, one would be the straight man and one would be Bootsy. And then we'd reverse it. So if it was the guy who was a software engineer, Joe Schrock might read that and I might be answering him. And it was that back and forth that got them seeing like, oh, okay, I get it. I get it. It was sometimes it was both. Like for the first round, I was in the room because AT&T is located. I mean, they were headquartered in Atlanta and I was working at BBDO Atlanta. But Joe Schrock was in New York and he was on the phone in New York. And there were other times it was just me. And sometimes it just depended on where we were. So I think the time it was there were half of us there and half of us over the phone.
That's awesome. So, I mean, that's an awesome story. So working backwards from there, you got to make these great spots. The way to sell them in, did you have, were you in the room with the client to sell them in? Or was that over the phone? I'm just trying to like work backwards how you convince the client that that's going to work out. And you know, whether they even knew who Bootsy was when you first were
we
pitching
would perform. I totally do. And this was a credit to Joe Schrock who taught me this. He's like, don't give them the script. It's going to drive them up the fucking wall, but don't give them the script. Because if you give them the script, they're going to start reading. And if they start reading, they're only going to look for how many times you mention their product or what the... And they're not going to... they're not going to be as receptive to it because they're not listening to it as their audience would, right? So after a while... And this is also a credit to the AT&T client at the time... It drove him up the wall at first, but after a while, he got used to it. He understood why we were doing it. And I think it really made them appreciate radio more and see the value not just as this dumping ground for the secondary and tertiary message of every last feature of the phone, but as a being kind of as important as TV in the sense that you were entertaining and that you could do both. Right.
Yeah. Was this in the room or over the phone?
I mean, they were recapping, of course, the need to make better radio, not just from the agency standpoint, but also the strategic standpoint of increasing the brand presence on radio, being more entertaining and selling more phones. And I'm sure there was a bunch of research that showed the necessity in terms of the listener and what they were expecting from that particular medium. And then they presented three different directions. When we got to the Bootsy direction, we had a photo of Bootsy. We said, how many people know who this is? And, you know, the majority of them raised their hands. You don't know who he is. This is Bootsy Collins. He was part of Parliament Funkadelic in the 70s. He has this very strong personality. He's very likable. He's transcended demographics because, you know, we mentioned the Groove is in the Heart video. And we mentioned a couple other things and said that we actually believe that he would be a great spokesman for AT&T. And here's why. And then we gave a sort of touch points of the character and what he could do. And then we started reading the scripts. And then after we read the scripts, we would pass the scripts out. And we would do this at every meeting, not just the first one when we sold it, but every ensuing meeting to make sure that they were hearing it first before reading it.
And this is I'm just getting kind of nitpicky sort of with this, but or detail-y with this, but when you pitch something like this, and this is just total, you know, kind of inside baseball, do you want to give the client the script in hand? Do you have them reading along, or do you kind of like keep it close because you want to perform the whole thing to them?
That's exactly it. And
you know
and,
what I'm saying,
but also help them establish his character, because the guy who's playing on stage, you know, with George Clinton and the other guy wearing a diaper when they're gored on whatever they ingested that night is actually not the person that to be doing this, right? It's a colorful character, and we believe that the colorful character is super important. Yeah. But the thing about Bootsy is that, you know, and it never even came up, but I did a lot of research. I mean, I know he's been clean and sober for a very long time. It's not like he was a liability. It's not like you're, you know, bringing in Lindsay Lohan to do this or something. They didn't have to take out insurance for him, is my point. But it was one of those instances in my career so far, my decade-long plus career, that has gone surprisingly smoothly, in that all of the questions I anticipated never really came up. But it's not to say that it wasn't important. I did my research, because it was, because you I'm sure you know, and I know Austin knows, is that you just don't know when a question's going to come up that might derail the whole thing if you don't have a ready answer for it.
So you're kind of anticipating the argument fully, right? You're thinking about, okay, I want to settle their mind about Bootsy before I even read the script. So I want them to know he's, you know, what are the things they're going to worry about him? Are people going to know who he is? Does he have a clean enough image? Does he align with our brand? Sort of thought. So you wanted to get that out of the way so they could focus on the script?
Yeah, it's a bit like, yeah, before you present something, you need to frame it in all, you know, soft, cushiony ways. Because once you've framed the client's mind into where you are with your scripts, then they can actually hear it. And I think that works for it, radio, TV, or print. It doesn't really matter. Or, you know, apps.
Well, one of the things I think that kills creative very quickly, even good creative, is the way in which it's presented. And, you know, we can say good presenter, bad presenter, but in this case, I really mean the lack of enthusiasm. Now, this is the first time we're talking. I mean, I know bits about you, but I don't know you as a person, but I'm sure you, like anybody else, has a passion, has something that you're really, really into, right? If I were to get you talking on that subject, it would be effortless for you to talk on it, right? Let's say you're a huge baseball fan. You would go on and on and on and on about baseball, and it would come from a genuine place. Now, if you don't like basketball, let's say, it's going to be a struggle for you to maintain the same enthusiasm about basketball as it would baseball. I think our job as creatives, regardless as of our medium, is to retain the enthusiasm regardless. And sometimes that can get really, really hard, because you're pushing something that's, you know, your 15th round, and it's what you consider your B level work instead of your A level work. But if you don't present it in the best manner possible, then you're doomed, because it's only going to be a matter of time where, even if it's your best work, you're not going to have the enthusiasm, you're going to be tired, and, you know, psychologically, people can pick that up even if they don't realize it, right? It may be a subconscious thing from your body language or from your lack of inflection in your voice or whatever, but they pick up on it, and then all of a sudden they're doubtful, and once the seed of doubt is planted, then you have to scramble.
And they're right. You know, if you're not enthusiastic about it, if you're not sort of dreaming yourself that you can create this thing, they're not going to care either. Like you were talking about your creative director that was really a proponent of just doing good radio, of doing it, you know, with grace and doing it properly and making it exciting and amazing. If you don't believe in that dream that work should be proper, and that what you're selling is the best thing that you have to sell, they aren't going to buy it either. Are you guys watching Mad Men this season? So there was a scene, I've been talking to everybody about it, I don't know why, but there was a scene in the first episode, or the first two episodes, whatever, of Peggy, who's now a creative director at a different agency, and she had to revise an ad for a client, and, you know, the client kind of sort of made a client style change where they removed the whole concept from the ad, and Peggy goes, yeah, okay, you've solved it in the sense that it makes... It kind of works now, but it's not a good ad, so we have to keep working. And it almost, I think, to me, that was like the watershed moment of the whole series of what sort of Mad Men could have all been about, beyond all the philandering and all the hatred and evil things that just anybody could do to each other. When they talk about the ad business, it really cemented that weird notion that this is a business where we care more about what we're making than the clients who it's for. It's their ad, right? We don't really care if people eat more beans or wear those headphones in her case. Like, you know, we just care about doing things properly, sort of. It's not that I don't care if people buy the product, right? But I don't gain from that. I don't immediately benefit from that. I benefit from making a great communication piece.
That is pretty funny, but it's also pretty funny that you said that the client comes in and changes something, because that reminded me of, like, well, I'm sure you saw it, where I was doing the agency life tweets, and one of the things was the classic Frankenstein. I said the client comes in and he says, I like the headline from this ad, and I like the photograph from that ad, and I like the typography in this ad. So, you know, demands that you merge it together into one ad. And that was retweeted God knows how many times. So apparently every single advertising agency in the world has experienced this. And but now I'm getting all these people saying that I'm whining. I'm not really whining when I'm doing those. I'm just cracking jokes that I'm sure everybody recognizes.
Evan, thanks a lot for doing this with us. It was absolutely interesting. I think in some ways this is, you know, just getting into the nitty gritties of how advertising is made should be what this podcast is about.
Yeah. Agreed. Yeah. So, yeah, thank you, Evan, for joining us tonight. That was awesome.
Yeah, no worries.